Today, I want to deal with, I'll call it an introduction, really, an introduction to issues that at the core, before I tell you exactly what I want to get to, I'll tell you what I want to get to. I want to get to eventually to euthanasia. But before I get to euthanasia, there's a couple of primary things, and I need to explain that also. When it comes to trying to discuss, in terms of Jewish law, topics, sometimes a topic is discussed clearly, obviously, in the Jewish sources. Sometimes that's not the case, which means sometimes what happens instead is that I need to go looking around to find the discussion which is going to be relevant for that particular issue, which is more of the case over here. But a little bit more of the background first. One of the blessings and curses of modern society is something which I will call autonomy. When I talk about autonomy, I mean the fact that we have so much freedom, the fact that we have so much liberties. So the liberties that we have, I called it a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because for most of history, people did not have these kinds of liberties. It's a curse because sometimes we get carried away in terms of thinking the freedom that we have. And sometimes we may overextend it. I think the issue of autonomy, again, more so in your world than my world, so I'm sorry for that distinction, is you've been brought up in a society which will tell you, just for example, that you have the right to choose your gender. That's something which I think you appreciate for most of history. Someone would have thought that that's an absurdity. And it's not just because of the technical ability of being able to do surgery versus the technical ability or inability in the past. It's something which modern society will tell you that you have the right to make these decisions. Modern men, women, have an exaggerated sense of autonomy. One of the applications of this that I want to get to is, do I have the right to decide when I'm going to die? I think it's a pretty fair question. And you can say that, of course, you have this right because it's your life. Or you can say, well, no, you don't. I mean, in a technical, formal sense, if one of the Ten Commandments is that you are not allowed to murder, does it make a difference who the victim is? Do you understand my question? If murder is wrong, so then why would it make a difference who the victim is, in the sense that why does it make a difference if the victim is somebody else or the victim is me? If murder is wrong, but you can say, but it says in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder, lo tirtzach. So did it also have to say, lo titabed? Do not commit suicide. So I'm just using that as an example. Or can I then extend it and say that I would like there to be a decision that a person could make that they want to end their lives and that should be respected? So I'm saying I see this within the larger construct of personal autonomy. But nonetheless, I want to read a case which is completely frivolous, except it's serious, but it's frivolous, completely frivolous. It's somebody by the name of Ronald Opis. Have any of you ever heard of Ronald Opis? Good. So today you will. Well, yes, you're ahead of the game then. Yes, it is absolutely a fake story, but and it was made up by a man named Don Harper Mills, and it was presented to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Now, the fact that it was made up does not stop it from being really popular. This fellow, Ronald Opis, has been killed many, many times in movies, television shows, other places, YouTubes. Now you know the name. You'll be able to look him up and you can see a discussion of what exactly happened. But I want to read the case to you because there's a certain element over here which is really interesting to me, but we're not going to know why yet. It's going to take a while for us to get there. And I'm not saying we're going to get there necessarily today. On March 23rd, 1994, and I did this, send this to you, a medical examiner viewed the body of Ronald Opis and concluded that he died from a gunshot wound of the head caused by a shotgun. Are you all with me? Medical examiner looks at the body, finds that this person died by a gunshot wound. Investigation to that point had revealed that the descendant had jumped from the top of a 10-story building with an intent to commit suicide. He left a note indicating his despondency. By the way, one of the things, and if you weren't here last semester, then I apologize, one of the things that when we discussed the trolley case last semester, and the woman who made up the trolley case, she, I don't know if this is important, but she was an atheist. It's probably quite important. But one of the things that she said is that very often things we do have all kinds of consequences. So she said, for example, if somebody goes to college, then they're more likely to commit suicide than if they haven't gone to college. So therefore, you're taking responsibility when you're encouraging people to go to college. By the way, do you like that statistic or you don't like that statistic? It seems to be that the more educated somebody is, the more likely to commit suicide. Do they understand more or do they understand less? You can make that determination. And by the way, you can check if her statistics are real or not. But over here, Ronald Opus, who never existed, so maybe we'll argue then that he was indeed a college graduate because now it becomes a little bit more likely. And let's continue. Again, he died of a gunshot wound, but investigation to that point revealed that the descendant had jumped from the top of a 10-story building with the intent to commit suicide. He left a note indicating despondency. As he passed the ninth floor on the way down, his life was interrupted by a shotgun blast through a window, killing him instantly. Neither the shooter nor the descendant was aware that a safety net had been erected at the eighth floor level to protect some window washers, and that the descendant would most likely not have been able to complete his intent to commit suicide because of this. Are you still with me on the case? So far, trying this all over again. There's a fellow, Ronald Opus, who died from a gunshot wound. He had jumped off on the 10th floor, was hit by a shotgun on the 9th floor. He had tried to kill himself by jumping off on the 10th floor, but there was on the 8th floor some kind of a net, which most likely would have frustrated his ability to commit suicide. Ordinarily, a person who sets out to commit suicide and ultimately succeed, even if the mechanism might not be what they intended, is defined as having committed suicide. That he was shot on the way to certain death 9 stories below probably would not change his mode of death from suicide to homicide, but the fact that his suicide intent could not have been achieved under any circumstance caused the medical examiner to feel that he had a homicide on his hands. So far... We're not even halfway there. So far, would you rule this death suicide or homicide? Jumped off from the 10th floor, was shot as he passed the 9th floor, and in fact there was a net there by the 8th floor. So far, it indeed sounds like homicide. Only question, by the way, that still needs to be told is who killed him, yes? If somebody tries to commit suicide and takes some pills, but they're alive, and I take a gun out and shoot them 8 times in the head, I just asked you a question. Don't say no. Say yes or no. Did they commit suicide? Why did you just change your opinion? Go back to my introduction that you may not have heard. And that is that we do today have an exaggerated sense of personal autonomy that I get to make such decisions. So therefore, if a person makes a decision, I no longer want to live, is that his decision to make? Your whole approach is attitudinal, but is not based upon reality. So I want to pause there for a moment, which means if somebody would have taken poison that they're going to die in 10 minutes and there's no way of saving them, and then somebody shot a person who's going to die in 10 minutes, then I would accept your argument. But over here, the person jumps out of the window with intent to kill himself, but again, we still have to, which is really one of the reasons we're here. We have to evaluate, does he have the right to make that decision? So that's point number one. Point number two is by the 8th floor, there is something that would have frustrated his ability to actually die because there's a net over there. So jumping out from the 10th floor to the 8th floor would not have killed him. So now you're going to have to try to explain to me why when somebody shot him by the 9th floor, they have no responsibility. And your argument is because this person already forfeited his right to live. But that doesn't make a difference because this case, as opposed to your case, this person would not have succeeded because of the netting. In the case that I just now presented, where he took the poison and maybe he's going to die in 10 minutes, then I'm willing to entertain your possibility, but not in this case. If somebody tries to commit suicide and fails, and somebody else kills them, so the guy who shot him has no responsibility?
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying
so what are you saying?
Assisted...
Oh, no, whenever someone says think about it, I know it's going the wrong way.
So sorry.
He jumped off the building. Let's do this again. Shh. Guys. What does the Torah say? Lo tirtzach. In Bereishit it says, Shofech dam adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Sounds pretty much don't spill blood, don't kill. Okay, so let's do this again. So far, I hear an argument, which, by the way, I think it's an important argument. I just haven't been convinced yet. So far, I've heard an argument that if somebody tried to commit suicide, so first thing that I hear some of you saying, it's either the person has the right to do this, which we still need to discuss a little bit, or the fact that he tried to commit suicide means that his life now is of less value. So I'm really interested about that. Again, I want to go back and ask a question. Go back to where we want to get to in the end, euthanasia. If somebody tries to commit suicide but is still really quite alive and they get to the hospital and the nurse says, oh, this guy's going to need surgery and he's going to need this and need this to save his life, and they can save his life, and says, the hell with it. Why should we waste all kinds of resources to save this guy's life? He wanted to commit suicide. Let me just kill him. That's what he wants anyway. He does not deserve to have his life saved. So I understand emotionally why somebody would say that, but if a nurse does that, are you going to tell me that the criminal justice system, you just say, well, you know, that's okay? No, they killed somebody. I mean, do actions matter at all? Or over here, somebody jumped off of a window or out of a window wanting to kill themselves, and they would not have succeeded. Somebody else shot them. So you're saying the person who shot them has no responsibility because they would have died anyway, but that's not true. They thought they would have died anyway. So now the question is, what is the fact that they thought they would die anyway make a difference? So hold on that point for a second.
Yeah.
Further investigation led to the discovery that the room on the ninth floor, whence the shotgun blast emanated, was occupied by an elderly man and his wife. He was threatening her with the shotgun because of an interspousal spat, and became so upset that he could not hold the shotgun straight. Therefore, when he pulled the trigger, he completely missed his wife. The pellets went through the window, striking the descendant. So, here was an attempted murder. The husband tried to kill his wife, missed the wife, it went through the window, killed the fellow who was attempting to commit suicide. So now the question is, you know, look, theoretically, if I try to kill you, but I miss and I kill you, do I have any kind of responsibility? I can say, no, listen, I tried to kill him. It wasn't an intentional murder. It was unintentional because I can't shoot straight. Can we continue with this case? Because the truth is, this is the best case ever in the history of the world, which is why, you know, somebody made it up. So let me now continue a little bit more. So far, those of you who have totally lost focus, this is the story of Ronald Opis. Ronald Opis died. That's how we started. Death was by shotgun blast. Background was he had jumped out of the 10th story, got hit by the bullet by the 9th story. He would have been saved by the 8th story because there was a net there, but instead the bullet got him first, and you were all discussing whether it was murder or suicide over here. But so the little twist over here, now we know, is that the reason the bullet went through the window is because somebody was trying to kill his wife, missed his wife, and in fact hit poor Ronald Opis. Continue. He was threatening her with the shotgun because of the spat and so on. Therefore, when he pulled the trigger, he completely missed his wife and the pellets went through the window, striking the descendant. When one intends to kill subject A, but kills subject B, in the attempt, when one intends to kill subject A, but kills subject B in the attempt, one is guilty of the murder of subject B. By the way, right now, we're talking in terms of American law, and I'm not talking yet in terms of halakha, which obviously we want to get to at some point. In the attempt of murder, if somebody else's murder while you're trying to commit a murder, that is also considered to be a murder. Your defense that you're trying to kill somebody else is not considered, in American law at least, a defense, because you killed somebody in the act of killing somebody. So it's sort of like American law will extend the murder clause to somebody who's killed in the middle of a violent crime. The fact you weren't trying to kill them doesn't make a difference because you weren't trying to commit murder. So therefore, the whole issue in American law, what is murder, what is first-degree murder, second-degree murder, what is manslaughter, and so on. But over here, because it was during a crime taking place, trying to kill somebody, that's why there would be responsibility in murder. You could then, maybe it's not in the first degree, maybe it's second degree. Very hard to call it first-degree murder because it wasn't premeditated to kill him, but nonetheless it would be considered murder. So I'm saying these are technical issues in law. When any of you finish law school, again, when one intends to kill subject A but kill subject B in the attempt, one is guilty of murder of subject B. The old man was confronted with this conclusion, but both he and his wife were adamant in stating that neither knew that the shotgun was loaded. It was the longtime habit of the old man to threaten his wife with an unloaded shotgun. That's what they did for kicks. He would get upset. She would get upset. He'd take out the shotgun and say, "I'm going to kill you." But the shotgun never had any bullets in it, which means somebody put bullets in the shotgun, and that's what we still need now to figure out. Let's continue then. Again, the old man was confronted with this conclusion. Both he and his wife were adamant in stating that neither knew the shotgun was loaded. It was a long-time habit of the old man to threaten his wife with an unloaded shotgun. He had no intent to murder her. Therefore, the killing of the decedent appeared then to be an accident. That is, the gun had been accidentally loaded. So now, we just now were able to go down from, how did we start? Attempted suicide, turned into murder, now got downloaded to manslaughter, yes, because it was an accident, because as far as he knew, he wasn't involved in a crime, because he wasn't trying to kill somebody, because he wasn't trying to shoot somebody, because as far as he knew, there were no bullets in the gun. He said he never put bullets in. There were never any bullets in the gun. You ready for the surprise ending? Now comes, one second. But further investigation turned up a witness that their son was seen loading the shotgun approximately 6 weeks prior to the fatal accident. That investigation showed that the mother, the old lady, had cut off her son's financial support, and her son, knowing the propensity of his father to use the shotgun threateningly, loaded the gun with the expectation that the father would shoot his mother. So now who's responsible for the murder of Ronald Opus? The case now becomes one of murder on the part of the son of the death of Ronald Opus. Now comes the exquisite twist. Further investigation revealed that the son, Ronald Opus himself, had become increasingly despondent over the failure of his attempt to get his mother murdered. That led him to jump off the 10-story building on March 23rd, only to be killed by a shotgun blast through the 9th-story window. The medical examiner closed the case as suicide. Okay, so why is this case important? Why is this case important? No, the case is important, one, because when you draw conclusions before you have all the evidence, you may very well end up with the wrong conclusion. That's one thing here along the way. That ultimately knowing who shot the gun, why they shot the gun, did they think they were shooting a gun, who loaded the gun, what was the intent of the person who loaded the gun, I mean, all of these end up becoming important. But I do want to get back to what some of you had said along the way, some of your comments along the way, and that is shooting somebody who was trying to kill themselves, and of course a big difference over here was the net. I want to go backwards a second. What if there were no net? If there were no net, would that change the situation? Look, at the end of the day, at the end of the day in this case, and again, in this, I'll say it again. This case is made up. It's made up by somebody who's a medical examiner trying to show other medical examiners that you can't draw conclusions just because you see something. You need to do a lot more. There must be a lot more investigative work done before one can draw conclusions. Yeah. Okay.
No, I accept that. I think there's limits to how important this case is. I'm going to place it aside now. We're going to come back to it at some point, much more likely next week. But I want to come back now and ask a more fundamental question. Again, the place I want to get to is euthanasia. Does everybody here know exactly what I mean by the term euthanasia? To euthanize. Euthanasia is a term which is used, and by the way, all terminology has politics to it. Euthanasia, if you look up the word, it will be translated as mercy killing. So that's such an interesting pair of words. What if instead of calling it mercy killing, I called it compassionate murder? No, there's a difference between killing versus murder. Murder sounds worse. Right, killing and murder almost by definition means, right, murder almost by definition means that you're doing it in an unjustified way. Again, what's the difference between killing and murder? You can kill somebody in self-defense, you don't murder in self-defense. Murder is not justified. What exactly is murder? Murder would be the taking of a life with intent and lack of justification. I think those are the elements that you need. In order for something to be considered, again, I kill in self-defense, I'm doing it on purpose. We can argue whether it is premeditated, not premeditated, but the biggest difference is going to be that it's justified. It's justified because somebody's threatening me. People in the back, you don't have to be here. I know that's a surprise. There are other classes going on. So, I think the fundamental question becomes, in terms of, again, euthanasia, is the ending of a life ever justified because of compassion? I think that becomes the question. I do want to make a statement about this. I do want to make an observation, and what I'm going to say now is probably more important than you realize as I'm saying it. But I want this to go in. Where do you want to draw the line with euthanasia? If you want to allow it, do you want to allow euthanasia? Again, euthanasia means mercy killing or compassionate murder, whatever you want to call it. If we're in favor of it, I'm saying we as a society are in favor of it, essentially means if someone decides they don't want to be alive, then society has the right to approve that, not only, therefore, approving suicide, but approving what we can call assisted suicide. There was a doctor whose name was Dr. Kevorkian. He made a career at some point, towards the end of his career, of doing assisted suicides, teaching people how to kill themselves effectively. Not always, because sometimes people are in such a severe situation, which is why they want to kill themselves, that having the manual dexterity to do it is not always simple. So he helped develop, again, you decide now, murder apparatus or assisted suicide apparatus. In order, and by the way, he ended up being convicted of murder. Yeah, so that's part of what I wanted to say. One, where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line by somebody who has a terminal situation, define terminal now? Okay, but I want to define terminal first. Do you want to say terminal means that they will die anyway within the next, now you could decide when. You could decide next week, month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. You could define what terminal means right now. I mean, ultimately, so far, in terms of the evidence that we have, birth is a terminal illness, and every single person who's experienced birth sooner or later experiences death. That is the objective way of looking at the world. So life is a terminal situation. For some people, we hope it'll be a lot later on, but the question is, how do you want to define terminal? Do you want to find a terminal illness or a terminal situation that somebody will die based upon current medical knowledge within the next, now you can fill in that blank for me, what you want to define as terminal, where somebody should have the right to say that, oh, we think if that's the case, then they should be not only allowed to kill themselves, but we should be allowed to help them to kill themselves. Which means, when I go back to this issue of autonomy, that I should have the right, do I truly have the right over my body? Do I truly have the right over someone else's body? Let me tell you something about the Middle Ages in Ashkenaz. During the Crusades, there were people who were 100% convinced during the Crusades that they would be given the choice of dying or converting to Christianity, but when that happens, even if they go down in a blaze and they go down and refuse and are killed, their children will be kidnapped and forcibly converted. Would there be any kind of a moral defense in killing children to prevent them from being raised as Christians? This is a real question during the Middle Ages. I'm not saying this is a theoretical at all. This was a real question that came up. Is that considered to be justified or not? And I can tell you right now that that was something which happened during the Middle Ages, and then the debate can take place afterwards. Was this right or was this wrong? Let me go back to a more normative case, you know, that we would deal with, and that would be a case of somebody who has a terminal illness. Okay, let's say they don't have a terminal illness. Let's say the person, instead of a terminal illness, has pain. Let me start all over again. You walk into a hospital, and there's somebody there in pain. And the person says, I am in pain. Can you please help me kill myself? I don't have the dexterity to kill myself. Is it moral to help that person kill themselves? Or is it immoral to help that person kill themselves? So I'm just saying, just like we saw in the Ronald Opis case, you don't necessarily have all the information. All that I just now, just think about the case I just now said. Someone's in pain and says, can you help me kill myself? Or can you actually kill me? So is that moral or not moral? Very good. But think about all the problems in the sentence that I gave. What degree of pain? Get to be my age, you have pain all the time. Low-level pain. Arthritis. I feel it in both shoulders. I feel it in both knees. I feel it in my left ankle. Every day. More or less. I never used the word unbearable. I know, that's why I deliberately did not use the word bearable, unavailable. All that I said is pain. So good, I'm saying that's exactly the kind of thing that needs to be clarified. What if somebody's in pain? In the Norwegian countries right now, assisted suicide for somebody in depression is legal. One second, is that a scary statement that I just now said? Assisted suicide for somebody with depression is legal because that person's in pain. They want to kill themselves. It's hard for them. They don't have the guts to do it. So you're allowed to help them kill themselves. I want to come back to your point. It's an excellent point. I want you to, somebody write down the following two words for me. I'm going to ask you to remind me. Two words, morphine protocol. Who's going to remind me of that? When elderly people get very sick, hospitals virtually never recommend treating them with antidepressants. That's the point, which is incredibly important. I'll say it again. When elderly people are sick, hospitals virtually never give them antidepressants. Full stop. If somebody is depressed, it will be more difficult for them to have a will to live. Essentially, we as a society have a bias that if you're elderly and sick, so that's realistic, and you're going to die sooner or later, deal with it. But we all know, and if we don't know this, we need to know this, we all know that the individual who has more of a will to live is much more likely to survive than the person who doesn't have the will to live. So that same elderly person, if you gave them antidepressants, will much likely survive a far greater time than if you don't give them the antidepressants, but there's a bias in our society and say, listen, you're realistic. Yeah, you're old, you're going to die. That's it. Which means the lack of dealing with the emotional health of individuals who are in severe situations is, in my mind, criminal. Okay, so let's pause there for a second. What were the two words I want? Yeah. As a rabbi, dealing with corona and having various questions asked of me for the last, whatever it is, 8-9 months, it has absolutely been part of the consideration that I make when I give various rulings. 100% that that's a concern. And you're completely correct that that is something that needs, you know, to be dealt with. Because loneliness is something which is very frightening. I mean, thank God. I mean, my parents have almost not left their house since March.
I think about the elderly, it's like using their
word. My parents in the next month will turn, God willing, 89 and 87. Okay? My father gives a Gemara share every day over Zoom. It's unbelievable. But they've been alone. So at least they have the two of them. They're, you know, they're together. That's at least a part of it. And children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren come and visit outside and whatever. But by the way, if I come to their house, they won't wear a mask or whatever. And I say, please, let's sit outside. And they deal with it as they do. But if somebody was by themselves, I mean, a lot of my friends only have one parent right now, elderly. And I always ask them, so how's your mother doing? How's your father? Whatever. It's very frightening for people to be all by themselves and not have anybody there. I mean, look how we can be depressed. And look at you. Listen. It was absolutely brilliant of your parents to send you to Israel. I'm serious about this. And to be together with another 100 kids than to be locked in your house alone with them and driving them crazy. We could have charged your parents double this year. You should know that. They would have paid that to get rid of you. What? No, I'm saying, just think a second how fortunate you are that you'll have a bunch of other people with you. And even this, it's like, it's not easy. But for one elderly person to be living by themselves, especially that elderly person who's not great with technology, that, I agree with you. It's completely frightening. What were the two words that I wanted?
Morphine
protocol. Many years ago, I was teaching medical ethics one-on-one with a fellow who was, I could say which hospital it was right now. I could say because it's so long ago that even if the police hear this at this point, they most... No. Sloan Kettering. Sloan Kettering in New York. I don't know about the commercials, but Sloan Kettering is one of the best hospitals for cancer in the East Coast. So this fellow was the head of... He was the head, I'm just trying to remember what it was. I think he dealt with things of lung cancer. I think that was the exact thing, but I apologize if I don't remember the exact expertise that he had. So we were speaking about the issue of euthanasia, and he said to me that when patients are terminal, by the way, again, important word, what does terminal mean when said by an oncologist? What is a terminal when an oncologist uses it? What he's saying is there's nothing that I know to deal with it. That's what he's saying. I don't know how to deal with it. Which means really likely the person will not survive. By the way, I go back to my timeline. Does the person not survive? Does that mean a week? Does that mean a month? Does that mean a year? Does that mean 6 months? What do you do? So he told me that when he has terminal patients in his ICU unit, he says he puts them on, what was the term I looked for? A morphine protocol. Anybody know what that is? Good. So morphine is a great way of dealing with pain. Morphine, but there's a problem with morphine. What's the problem? Addiction. So addiction is not a big issue if you're a terminal patient. But there's another problem with morphine. Okay, but there's another problem with morphine. There's a built-in problem with morphine. Exactly. You build up a tolerance, so then what do you have to do? You have to start giving them more and more and more. Which, by the way, right then, guys, right then creates
Anybody want to speak about that? Is it like, it's like any drug. Do you want to? Okay. Which right then creates an interesting dilemma. If somebody's in pain and you can give them morphine and it will take away the pain, is it moral to give them morphine? So the answer is obviously that can give them the ability to deal with pain. But what if you give them a dosage which you know will kill them? See, what morphine will do is it will also slow down breathing, it will slow down heart functions, it will slow down the whole system. So therefore, a small amount of morphine is going to take the edge off. A bigger amount of morphine will actually totally chill the individual. But a great deal of morphine will kill you. So to make this part simple, in terms of Jewish law, So in terms of Jewish law, to give a dose of morphine which will help a person with pain is perfectly allowed 100%, even though along the line they may have to get more and more and more and more and more, and it could be eventually that they will die, but it's no problem giving them that first, second, third, or fourth. Meaning you can't give them that dosage that you know will kill them, but you can give that amount of morphine that will take away pain. So now, when he told me morphine, so I said, so what do you deal with people who are terminal? So he said, I put them on a morphine protocol. And I said, morphine protocol? And he said, yeah, morphine protocol. I said, and what happens with this? I understood exactly where it was going. So he says, so now we'll go back a second, and we're going to end with this for today. He says as follows. He said, I'll call on the family. And by the way, realize the lack of symmetry. Doctor, knowing, expert, family, halfway mourning, depressed, says, I'm sorry to tell you that your loved one has a terminal disease and we have no way of healing it. So what's going to happen? What's the answer? What's going to happen? They're going to die. But the doctor instead says, we'll put them on a morphine protocol. That's why you have to remember those words. And the parent, and they don't say morphine protocol. Rather, they'll say, like, he said, no, we'll help him manage the pain. Pain management. By the way, that all sounded great. No problem. Except when I asked him, I said, morphine protocol? So he said, yeah, we sort of give them large doses of morphine, which clears up hospital beds right away, especially when the insurance is no longer paying. So then it becomes the moral thing to do. So we tell them we're going to give them morphine protocol, which then within a week or so they'll be. So I said, so how do you get away with it? Because essentially what he just now told me is that they will kill all patients that they can no longer heal. That's what he told me. So I said, how do you get away with it? So he said, brilliant. You ready? He said that when we write out the morphine prescription, we base it on the body weight when they came into the hospital before they started losing a great deal of weight. So therefore, the amount of morphine that they would have needed at that point is much more than they need at this point. And essentially, within a couple of days, they end up dying from their morphine protocol. And I'm telling you, I was sitting in a room talking to this person, feeling that I'm talking to a mass murderer.
That's crazy.
And I said to him, so how exactly does this work with the Hippocratic Oath? Hippocratic Oath is that you're going to heal people. So his response was, we need to be creative in our interpretation of the Hippocratic Oath. That was his response. Mass murderer. Yes, I taught a mass murderer. You think you guys are bad. I taught a mass murderer. So, what did we do today? What we did today is that we started to speak about autonomy. We started to speak about the right, as it were, to end your life or end another life. We didn't get anywhere in terms of Jewish sources today. We have to start looking at Jewish sources as we move on. We learned the case of Ronald Opus, which if nothing else is interesting, but I'm still going to come back to him because there's something there that we're going to need, but we don't know what that is yet. We talked about depression along with any illness and how our society really needs to try to make people happier as much as we can, and it'll make a huge difference. But we have a bias, and the bias is that people that are terminal should die. And I'm just telling you that a lot of big... And it's this... It's what I told you in the first class, in the first semester. If you weren't there, then I apologize. It's this unholy alliance between legality, medicine, and money, or insurance, or cost. In this case, part of the motivation was that the insurance is no longer paying. And by the way, there's a flip side of this, which maybe is a very good consideration. We can use those hospital beds for maybe people that we can heal. That's an interesting issue. But part of the problem is, I don't like the word terminal. I would prefer a doctor to say that we don't know what to do with them, not that they're going to die. Once you decide they're going to die, the next step may very well be, and let me help them on the way out. And that's, yeah, the person's going to die. Let me help them. No longer give any antidepressants to them. Don't even think about that because they're going to die. Put them on the morphine protocol and then euthanize them. By the way, euthanize them is a nice way of saying kill them with love, right? Kill them with love. Okay, we will continue from here next time. Bezrat Hashem. Sorry for being so depressing.